Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. Tonight, the main science topic, I will be discussing some work on prime numbers and some of the, let's just say, important issues dealing with higher-level mathematics. Many times, people who are professionals listen to this program, and a subject that has been one of the big outstanding problems in mathematics for well over 150 years, actually much longer than that, involves what is known as mathematical analysis, the density of the prime numbers. There's many ways to look at this problem, but I'll be discussing the problem right now with the politics of science or the politics of mathematics in a group of people who have control dealing with preventing information from coming to light. And there's a concept, all of these are very related. There's a concept that surfaced in mathematics a very long time ago that the prime numbers are random. And this is something I disproved with my work on calculating prime numbers directly, showing that there are very intricate patterns, the wave nature of prime numbers, closure, reciprocity, symmetry, all kinds of amazing mathematical properties involved in the prime numbers. Not only that, but there are some higher level mathematical results that lend new vision into this entire problem. It also disproves some of the previously held, what you might call important mathematical papers that have been published. And one of the prime ones is that, not to use the term too much, but one of the major results that have been published, which turn out to be absolutely incorrect, is that the prime numbers are random. So anyway, that's a very complicated topic, but it's one that's being... here's the problem. In peer-reviewed science or mathematics, once something is published, it's very difficult to get it unpublished. When something in the sciences or in mathematics receives a prize of some kind, for in this case the field prize for mathematics, it's even triply difficult. It's almost like infinitely difficult to get that information removed and reversed. And especially it becomes infinity to the infinite power difficult if the person refereeing the journal happens to be the person who published that paper. And so anyway, this is a complex topic. I'll be discussing it at the end of the show. Just a quick comment here on an article sent in by a listener. The 1964 Chrysler, they produced a turbine car, and I got a letter from a listener who was partially responsible for design of this car. The turbine engine would burn anything, gasoline, perfume, even whiskey. So anyway, this is something a person wanted me to promote on this show, is that sometimes I'm rather difficult with Detroit, but he said they had their difficulties dealing with foreign imports, specifically Volkswagen, Mercedes, and also, anyway, he talks about the ice queens, Elizabeth and Beatrix, British Petroleum, plus Royal Dutch Shell, and these companies, if you want to call them that, influence on the world. But at any rate, just to note that this 1964 Chrysler, and I remember that too as a kid. I remember them coming out with turbine cars. The engine was basically a turbine, just a spinning wheel, almost like a jet engine. Could burn any type of fuel at all, very economical also. Just picking up where I left off last week, I kind of ran out of time last week. I was racing to the end of the show, didn't realize that all of a sudden the show was over, so I quick gave an ending. Let me continue that vein of thought this week, talking about ancient atmospheres of Earth. And, of course, last week I talked about the fact that the atmosphere had changed many times during the history of Earth. We had, I believe, 11, the count is something like 11, although depending on who you talk to, that may change, but approximately 11 major Earth-wide mass extinctions. This is where just about everything on the planet went back to not the cave ages, but just almost a complete extinction. The most minimal cellular animals living beyond some of these mass extinctions, which would tell you that it wasn't simply an asteroid colliding into Earth. There were many other effects that took place, including mountain building, changing of the atmosphere, not the least of which is changing of the atmosphere, the atmospheric composition, and or the complete destruction of the atmosphere. Now, just a quick mention of Mars, this whole issue brings up some major questions. How many major changes have there been on Earth? And this is the major Earth-wide events. We do have one in recorded history that was known to have been caused by a comet. This is the Venus event. On my 2-CD disc set, I have I differentiate between the Great Flood, which was one event, and then followed thousands of years later by the Moses event. These are cataloged. In fact, this is what the Old Testament is all about in all the ancient texts. The Kolbrin, they deal with these ancient catastrophes, which were the most important formative events in the history of the world. But oddly enough, none of this is taught to the public these days. I have asked preachers, I have asked priests, I've asked knowledgeable people in the hierarchy of the various world religions about the catastrophes that happened in the past, and they all say, well, this is kind of like mythology. It really did not happen. You have to make interpretations. And they try and pass it off as some kind of mythology, pretend, exaggeration on the part of the ancients, etc. So that was one of the questions that follows. How many major changes have there been on Earth? What is the process that causes these major Earth-wide changes? And, of course, this is the comet event. Now, most people who have listened to traditional science think, oh, well, a comet has to crash into Earth. No, they don't crash into Earth. These are large comets. They're very rare. They come through the solar system, and it's something I have termed, coined the term action at a distance. These celestial events happen at a distance. Do we have evidence for this happening on other planets? And the answer is absolutely yes. Just recently, comet sighting Spring passed Mars very closely within 82,000 miles, caused a measurable increase in the atmosphere of Mars. Standard science is remiss to explain this. And of course, they don't even try. They just kind of sweep it under the rug that by any imaginable measure, the Dirty Snowball Comet model could not provide any increase in the atmosphere of Mars. So basically, Mars being a more massive object, and this is explained in my books with the Plasma Discharge Comet model, that in a tug of war between a comet, a passing comet, and a planet, there are two effects. First, it's the electrical connection between the electrical connection between the comet and planet, and then it's a tug of war of their gravitational fields. Which object has the larger gravitational field? And in this case, it was Mars. So not only does Mars have a gravitational field, but it became a comet because it joined the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor along with the comet And so Mars literally drew in more atmosphere. This is part of the process. And so, but let's go back into history. The ancients talk about Mars having its atmosphere stripped by the passage of that comet Venus. And that's the same comet that came by Earth on two occasions and causing a pollution event on Earth. Well, here is the scenario. Now, I've talked about this many times on past programs, but I'll review it again. Here again, the nucleus, if you look at the planet Venus, it's intermediate in size between Earth and Mars. So when that nucleus and its electric field and its electrical discharge of the solar capacitor came by and interacted with Mars, it was larger than Mars, so basically its gravitational field won and pulled the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars, leaving it as the desolate planet that we see today. As that same comet came by Earth, Earth's gravitational field was larger. And remember, first of all, there's the electrical connection. This is what Moses, they talk about this, they saw it, they witnessed it, it's the electrical connection. They described it as a pillar of fire that extended up into the heavens. And of course, this was during the passage of the comet Venus. The Noah event was a completely different comet. We don't really have any idea what comet that may have been. We don't know. There's no real recording of it other than the fact that it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and obviously that water had to come from someplace. The Earth didn't just jump up and down and do this by itself one day, as standard science would like you to believe. And it was not the breaking of a dam in the Mideast someplace and a flooding of the Mediterranean Ocean. It was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. But in the case of Venus coming by Earth, remember, Venus in size and mass is intermediate between Mars and Earth. So Venus won the tug of war over the atmosphere when it came by Mars. In the case of Mars, and let me continue that vein of thought. When the comet came by Earth, the Venus comet, the protoplanet Venus comet came by Earth. Earth was had more a larger gravitational field, and therefore won the tug of war after the electrical connection had been made. So Earth experienced a tremendous pollution event, and the ancients talk about that, the influx of water. And also the hydrocarbons, the naphtha that came into the atmosphere, and the meteor stream. Now, when you come thousands of years later after the Moses event, Christ, the Sermon on the Mount, and the other, the end-day prophecies that came out of the lectures, and remember that Christ was a very well-educated person. He had known about the cauldron. His uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, was the cauldron that we see today is a residual of the library of Joseph of Arimathea, who was Christ's great uncle. He was the uncle of Mary. And so he's the one that took the cross, etc., went to England after the crucifixion and took his library and all his wealth with him. And that's where it ended up. And thousands of years later, the cauldron surfaced as a reproduction of that work, and I got one of the very first comet copies of the cauldron that came out. Three of them were brought into the United States, and they wanted one in my hands so that I could interpret what was in the cauldron. And by the way, if you go, it's spelled K-O-L-B-R-I-N. Look some information on my webpage about that, jmccsci.com. Also, remember that don't go to Amazon to buy the cauldron. There's some imitation copycat versions there that are just exactly that. So go and get the original cauldron. It's a beautiful big volume, well-bounded. I believe you get it at, I think they're still selling it. I won't tell you where. Just go on the internet at chaldeantrust.org. That website link is on my page. I'm not going to try and spell it on the air for you. Just go to my webpage. The link is there. And get the original copy. But the cauldron talks about the comets The very first part is the destruction of man, the rebirth of man, and the great comets of old. And then very specifically, they talk about the ancient great flood. They also talk about the all of the various effects of the great comets coming by Earth. They call them the sky monsters, basically, or the dragons, as the Chinese call them. Every ancient culture talks about these, yet modern science refuses to acknowledge this. It's not taught in the schools, and this is intentional. They want the public stupid so that you keep believing that you have to buy gasoline to power your cars, or that oil comes from fossil fuels, which is one of the most ridiculous scientific claims ever in the history of man, or that mountains are built by slow plate tectonic movements where these plates just magically roam around the Earth all by themselves. Nobody can explain to you what forces move entire continents around the globe, but in a textbook you see lots of nice pictures, subduction zone, all looks very pretty, but it doesn't work. There's no physics behind it. Where are the immense Herculean forces that move continents around the globe? But at any rate, going back to the original topic of atmospheres on planet Earth, it is extremely important to understand that the species that exist today did not evolve in the atmosphere that we have today. The atmosphere changed drastically during the Great Flood, and it once again changed drastically at the time of Moses. And the surface oil that we experience today on Earth, a lot of that oil in the Middle East or various other places around the world came in during that event. A lot of the deposits on Earth, the oil deposits, are very old. We have deposits, remember the BP oil spill? They're tapping into those high-pressure oil reserves that are way down there, like 5, 10, 15 kilometers under the surface of the Earth, are vast oil reserves, and when they punch a hole down there, the pressure, that liquid comes squirting out because the Earth, the solid part of the Earth, deforms. It's almost like a liquid, but the less dense liquid part comes up the hole and comes shooting out, and the pressure was so great they couldn't cap it, they couldn't contain it. That was the whole issue with the BP oil spill. But the whole issue regarding that scientifically is that where did that oil come from? You know, 12 kilometers under the surface of the Earth. Well, obviously, Earth has had some sessions, let's put it that way, with comets in the past. How many layers of Earth have been added over the billions of years? And the scientists claim that they look at the surface geology of the Earth, claiming that it is 4.5 billion years old. Well, that's the surface. They don't even look down below that. On the moon also, they talk about the surface rocks and claim that those are 4.5 billion years old, and then interpret the age of the solar system as 4.5 billion years. How absurd. The rocks on the moon have nothing to do with the formation of the moon. The moon is being bombarded constantly by rocks and meteors, etc., and micro dust, etc. And so the surface of the moon has absolutely nothing to do with the original formative stages of the moon. How absolutely ridiculously stupid. But this is what's taught to you, the general public. This is the garbage science that's pawned off on the public by the standard scientific community. So at any rate, those major questions come up. I just wanted to give a couple other examples. When Comet Ison passed Mars, we saw a visible brightening of the atmosphere of Mars. It was actually visible. I observed it myself. Many other people observed it. And, of course, mum's the word in the standard scientific community, but they could hardly keep the cat in the bag when the comet sighting spring passed, and Mars had a measurable increase in its atmosphere, in the size of its atmosphere. Remember in 1910, Halley's Comet, the Earth passed through the tail of Halley's Comet, and one of the characteristics was for many days after the passage, the night sky was illuminated. Now, what's all of that about? Well, Earth became a comet for a short period of time, connecting, picking up that electrical connection that the Halley's Comet somewhat handed off to it, almost like a baton. And the Earth gained a tail, so we saw the brightening of the night sky because of the tail. It's just like a comet tail is bright up in the sky. But anyway, this leads nicely into the next topic. And many, many people jumped on this one, sent in and asked for commentary. The Rosetta mission, and this was happening, the announcement was made, actually, the paper was released December 10th, so that was last Thursday. And I did not have enough time to research it before last Thursday's show, so I deferred it to this week's show. Anyway, last week, remember, I talked about the announcement from the Rosetta scientific team from the European Space Agency about organic molecules, that they had discovered organic molecules, and the article said on the nucleus, or just on the comet, whatever that means. A very deceptive article, and what they had observed were organic molecules in the atmosphere. The lander observed them by looking up. It did not discover them on the nucleus, and mum's the word. They are still very much not talking at all about the discovery of the Philae lander, which landed on the comet nucleus. They have data, but they're not releasing any of it. And so you get these gee-whiz gushing articles, which are totally misinformation, trying to mislead the public into thinking that that lander discovered organic molecules on the comet nucleus, which is totally false. In the article, they are specific about it being observed in the atmosphere of the comet. But in the actual data from the lander, which drilled a hole into the comet nucleus, now if those organic molecules were being released from the nucleus, they should be visible in the data of the lander. But if they let me tell you something, boys and girls, if they had discovered organic molecules on the nucleus or water or anything resembling it, you would see banner headlines across the planet. They would be written in the sky with some kind of, you know, aerial writing. That's how big a banner and neon lights flashing in your face you would see it. Obviously, they did not discover anything like that on the comet nucleus. So they're all sitting around the European Space Agency's laboratory or reception room, whatever, scratching their whatevers, trying to figure out why there is no organic molecule or water activity that they discovered on the nucleus, yet they see it up in the atmosphere of the comet. Well, that's because the nucleus is not giving anything off. Okay, fast forward back to December 10th, last Thursday. They come out and they release an article in Science Magazine, which is one of the biggest disinformation, fast-track, rubber-stamp, peer review journals for both the European Space Agency and for the Americans. And it's very curious. They didn't publish this in Nature, which is the English journal. They published it in Science, which is the American equivalent of what you'd call kind of a popular, high-level, peer-reviewed magazine. Here's what the article said. The articles claimed a measurement of water coming off the nucleus. And so, okay, there's another claim, coming off the nucleus. That's actually what it said in the verbiage in the abstract of the article. But when you actually go and see, what they're measuring is something above the comet nucleus. They're not measuring this on the comet nucleus, once again. And that's where they would have to measure it to imply or to confirm scientifically that it's the nucleus where this stuff is coming from. But they see it up above. They assume it's coming from the nucleus and therefore claim it's coming from the nucleus. Bad science, once again. These people are just, they're just intent on pushing that dirty snowball comet model, falsifying. This is lying. This is lying. This is falsifying data, trying to promote a theory that simply does not work. Anyway, this was measured with the Rosina spectrometer, which is on the Rosetta spacecraft, mind you. This is not the lander. This is the spacecraft orbiting the nucleus. So they're seeing water, but it has now water in outer space can be different than water on Earth. Water on Earth we know as H2O, and that's the dominant species of water here. In outer space, there's a D2O. It's deuterium, and it's a heavy form of water. Now, you might understand that that also is used in nuclear research. It's called heavy water. And literally is that, but the ratio of deuterium-based water to hydrogen-based water near the comet nucleus, now near is important because they detected it near the comet nucleus, not on the comet nucleus, and this is their result is valid, that the deuterium, the heavy water ratio that they observed in the atmosphere above the comet nucleus is 3 times the terrestrial value. Now, I'll just quickly refer to the article here. Okay, so the article I'm looking at here, this is the abstract from Science, published December 10th, 2014. The scientific result gives a deuterium heavy water ratio of 53 parts per 100,000. Which is 3 times the level found in Earth water. So the conclusion, which is interesting, which I agree with, is that comets in their current form could not be the source of Earth water. Okay, so what exactly is going on here? What are they measuring? Well, first of all, the water, whether it's deuterium water or hydrogen-based water, is not coming from the comet nucleus. Eventually, they talk about flying through one of the jets that they expect to come off the comet nucleus to actually directly measure the content, the species in the jets of material. But remember, I talked about this a number of weeks ago, remember in September all of a sudden there was a jet that came off the comet nucleus, the P67 comet nucleus, and they were like, wow, look at this, it's exploding in the water and et cetera. But remember that that is not the source of the water in the tail. The jets, in fact, they did not detect any water in the jet at all. It was just dust coming off the nucleus. And it, once again, they were there remiss trying to explain how dust can be coming off the nucleus and no water found. And that's because it's the electron beams coming from the sunward side that are hitting the comet nucleus and blasting those dust jets off the nucleus. But you have to ask, how does this comet tail form continually from one little jet that occurred in September? Well, of course, it's stupid. You'd have to be brain dead retarded to imagine that the comet tail, which they have been observing for literally years, somehow came from that one little jet that occurred in September. I mean, you'd have to be brain dead. But I don't know what these scientists are thinking. I know that some of them are thinking they can't say anything because their paycheck, their future, their retirement, the well-being of their families, everything in their existence depends on them going along with the party line. Okay, so enough of that. So let's talk about what they measured. The measurement is valid. That, and I believe that 53 parts per 100,000 is 5.3 times 10 to the minus 4 is actually what they give as the value of deuterium based water, the DH ratio. Now, they have measured the DH ratio in water found in comet tails by other means, this from spectrometers that look at the water in comet tails from a distance. And they find wildly varying results. Okay, well, gee, if these comets all formed out in that magical Oort cloud back at the beginning of the solar system, the Oort cloud that nobody can detect and nobody ever will be able to detect, which they assume is there, one of the great unproven assumptions of modern science. You would expect that because of the average, because of the long-term development of these, that the DH ratio would be very constant. This is a simple statistical issue, that if the comets formed in that region over a long enough period of time, that they would have the same DH ratio, but the comets don't. But the DH ratio, what is it dependent on? It depends on the water, on the hydrogen-deuterium ratio that's in outer space. Now let's go and look at that ratio someplace else. Let's look far out into the galaxy, away from Earth, away from our Sun, away from our solar system. Let's look out into outer space. The deuterium-hydrogen ratio in outer space is also exaggerated in favor of deuterium. In other words, there is more deuterium than hydrogen in the universe. Let me put this a different way. If you compare it to the DH, and I'm not going to say deuterium-hydrogen anymore, I'm just going to say DH ratio. So that's the deuterium-hydrogen ratio. And it can be found either in atomic or diatomic form in outer space, or it can be found mixed with water. So the H2O would be two parts of hydrogen, one part of water, so that hydrogen molecule combined with the water. Or the D2O, the heavy water, also the same issue. So you can find it either in the atomic form without the oxygen, without the water, or you can find the ratio in the water. By any standard, outer space in general, whether it's here in our own solar system or if it's on the far side of the galaxy, the DH ratio is higher than the DH ratio found in water on Earth. And that's kind of what we use as the, you might say, the gold standard, the norm, is where did the water on Earth come from? In the DH ratio, why is it lower on Earth? Where did the water come from on Earth? So in the article, it's just so amazing the way these scientists paste band-aids on their ridiculous theories. The second the data comes in contradictory, they say, well, the Earth must have been populated with water from asteroids, and back at the early part of the solar system, there must have been more water on asteroids than there is today. Well, gee, wouldn't that make them a comet? you call this hip pocket speculation. There's a term for surveyors, and that's kind of where the hip pocket came from. A guy walks out into the woods, and this used to happen up in the woods in the when there was logging going on, etc. And some guy with no idea what he was doing would have a compass in his back pocket. He'd flip it out and follow it around and establish the corners of sections or quarter sections or townships to decide where to cut the logs and where not to cut, where to stop cutting the logs. And usually there was kind of a joke that you'd take your axe when you got to the border of what you thought was the limit of your permitted cutting area. You'd take your axe and you'd throw it twice. You'd throw it as far as you could, and then you'd go pick it up and throw it again, and that's where you stopped cutting. Because who is to tell you that you were wrong? So that's where the term hip pocket came from. The guy with his compass, hip pocket surveying, it's called. And so basically, hip pocket theorization of space science is kind of the same. You flip that hip pocket theory out of your back pocket, and all of a sudden it becomes gospel truth. Everybody starts repeating it and life goes back to normal. There is so much hip pockets theorizing in science, it's just beyond control. When I used to be at Cornell daily, when the spacecraft data was coming in, it was coming in from all over Venus, Saturn, Jupiter, it was the data from the Pioneer and the the Voyager spacecraft was coming in. All that data was coming in from all over the place at the same time. They had atmospheric data. They had the early spacecraft that were sampling, like the ISWE spacecraft that were sampling the solar wind. All this data was coming in at the same time. And every day at the end of the day in the space science building in Cornell, they would have meetings discussing data. And of course, a lot of it had to do with the Voyagers that were going to Jupiter, Saturn, etc. And so the point is that as the data came in and the scientists saw it for the first time, there was a lot of hip pocket theorization going on. Somebody said, well, that might be due to this. And lo and behold, when the science or the Nature article was published in a week or a month or 2 months down the road, there was that idea published, refereed, and passed the rubber stamp referee report, and all of a sudden everybody started repeating it and became the gospel truth. And to this day, there was a lot of data that got swept under the rug and that nobody ever discussed because it really didn't fit the standard theory. So they said people just couldn't come up with quite enough hip pocket theorization, so it didn't even get out there into the published papers. But that's hip pocket theorization. So in the case of the Rosetta mission, the DH ratio is not commensurate with the DH ratio of water on Earth. The DH ratio in the comet atmosphere is not commensurate with the DH ratio in water on Earth. So here comes the hip pocket theorization. Oh, well, it must have been the asteroids that had the water, and they had a different ratio, and that's what populated with the Earth with water. Pure speculation. But this is coming from the head of the European Space Agency science team on the Rosetta mission. You see how quickly they are to jump, and instead of saying, hey, you know, this data contradicts previously held beliefs. So instead of stepping on any toes over there in the other department, they schmooze it over, put in that Schwanz factor of, okay, the Schwanz factor is when we were in college, when kids would go off and fake a lab. They didn't have time or the wherewithal to do a lab. So they'd go back, they got the end results from somebody, maybe copied it. They knew what the beginning of the experiment was supposed to be. They would fill it out from the end back to the middle and from the beginning into the experiment, the write-up. And then all of a sudden in the middle, there was a couple factors where the end material blended with the beginning material. And we called that, when the students would do that, we call that a Schwanz factor. You know, and if you were a professor or if you were teaching a class, you knew the students who really knew what they were doing and the ones who were thrown in the Schwanz factor. Well, it looks like most of those people graduated and got jobs at NASA or the European Space Agency. But let me pull back a little bit of criticism. It's a very valid result that they have, except they should not be saying that this is coming off the comet nucleus. Once again, a false result. It's something that they did not observe. They observed this in the atmosphere, and let me explain what they were observing. As the water forms, and now let me go back to the plasma discharge comet model. As the water forms in the atmosphere of the comet, the hydrogen and deuterium and oxygen, along with carbons, nitrogen, sulfur, all of the other compounds are coming in to that region because they're ionized, positively ionized. They're coming into the region of the comet nucleus and they start forming molecules. They can build up to the nucleotides of the DNA. They can, you know, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen molecules that form the basis of the nucleotides, which are the basis building blocks of DNA. All of those form. And so when I talked about organic molecules last week, that's where they were forming. They form in the tail. As the raw material, as the atoms come in, they start forming. Water is one of the primary molecules that forms in a comet. And, of course, if you have deuterium instead of hydrogen, you're going to get the heavy water forming instead of of hydrogen-based water. And so these are dependent on the ratios of those chemicals in outer space, out far beyond the comet where they're dragging in. That's basically a cosmic vacuum cleaner bringing in this material from outer space, and it's forming around the comet nucleus. As those ions form, as they come into the region around the comet nucleus, they interact with the electron cloud, which is around the comet nucleus. And the reason that comet nucleus has an electron cloud is because of the overall discharge and the solar capacitor discharge. The primary charge carrier are electrons from the sun in an electron beam. They hit the comet nucleus, and because of the backup pressure that they experience at the nucleus, there's a charge collection there, and it's negative. That's because the electrons are, it's like a rock in a stream. There's a pressure that builds up in that electron. It's an electron pressure, if you want to call it, in terms of thermodynamics, that's exactly what you would call it. That pressure builds up around the nucleus, so the ions are drifting in towards that. They meet each other in the electric field. They form the molecules, and they encounter the electron cloud, which neutralizes them. They very rapidly become neutralized, and that's in the region right around the nucleus, and they start drifting away in the solar wind. That is what the Rosetta spectrometer is measuring. It is not coming off the nucleus, and that's why they're sitting there over in that office in Europe scratching whatever body part they'd like to scratch and can't figure out why the nucleus, which they have data on, does not have any water or DH, deuterium water, heavy water, hydrogen-based water, organic molecules, nucleotides. It doesn't have any of these. The hole they drilled into the nucleus, I guarantee you, does not have a shred of any of these on the nucleus. It's a hot, dry rock, and they can't figure it out. They can't figure out why the nucleus doesn't have any of this stuff that they see up in the tail. They can't figure out. So they're sitting on the Philae lander data, and the lander went dead after a couple of days. It ran out of power. They did drill a hole. They did sample. They've got, my inside sources say they have identified a lot of material, but there ain't any organics. There ain't any water. There isn't any kind of water, heavy or light, hydrogen water, no organic molecules, and certainly nothing of a higher nature like nucleotides. Nothing like that on the comet nucleus. And why isn't there? Because that electron beam has blasted that nucleus clean of anything, and if there ever was anything there, it's been burnt onto the nucleus. Remember that it was Comet Build 2 that they measured the hydrocarbons, which you could call, in a sense, organic molecules. But they were burned. It was tar. It was hot, dry tar that was on the nucleus. It wasn't like oil or volatiles or benzene coming off or some other lighter, shorter chain organic molecule, carbon-based organic molecule. It wasn't anything like that. It was baked on. It was the very long chain tar. It was basically a long chain hydrocarbons baked onto the comet nucleus, and was a very high temperature, and it was not sublimating any of this material into outer space around the nucleus. The nucleus was not giving off any kind of material, yet from a distance you saw the comet tail, water, hydrogen, you saw the hydrogen cloud around the nucleus. You saw the ultraviolet and the X-ray signatures out in front of the nucleus. From a distance, you could measure all of these things, which are explained in the plasma discharge comet model, none of which should be there in a dirty snowball comet model. Why should you have an ionic hydrogen cloud out to great distances in the form of a sphere around a comet nucleus made of ice and water? And it doesn't make any sense. The reason it's there on the plasma discharge comet model is because that's the shield. That's the Debye shield. The positively charged hydrogen. Hydrogen is the most abundant species in the region, and so that's the bulk of the. It's also a. It's also the lightest element, and so closer to the nucleus, you would start to find heavier elements, possibly up to sulfur, closely conglomerated around the nucleus in the shield. And this is the electric shielding, the Debye shielding that goes around the comet nucleus, which is negatively charged. That's why after a certain distance, the Debye shielding distance, you don't detect the comet electric field. You can measure the oscillations in the magnetic field, and by the way, that's another thing that they measured. That was another thing that was in the data released about a month ago, that they detected very low oscillations, sub-hertz frequency oscillations of the magnetic fields. Well, that's the arms, that's the ionic arms out there swinging around like snakes in outer space. The electrical, the charged molecules and ions coming in, and as they come in, they start to pull themselves together into sheets and pinched currents, they're called. That's the technical term. They are pinched currents. The self-induced magnetic field pulls them together, and so they form streamers of current coming into the comet nucleus. The same happens with the electrons, because they're passing out in the opposite direction, out into the anti-sunward direction. They're forming pinched currents. These currents interact. The electrons going outbound, the ions coming inbound, those electrical currents interact. And you can detect the singing, the song of these very low frequency oscillations. You can detect that, and they did. They also could detect the electrical noise coming from the comet nucleus. Well, absolutely none of this should be happening with a dirty snowball. It should be inert. It should be electrically inert. There shouldn't be, there have been a few feeble attempts going way back into the 70s and 80s of people trying to publish that comets should have a electric field at the surface, but these are in the form of like 0.01 volts or something like that, ionic type of, due to ultraviolet light at the surface of the comet. A little bit of ionization, and so you might be able to justify a 0.1 volt at the comet nucleus, but certainly not enough to cause any kind of measurable effect. Certainly not enough to cause ultraviolet radiation or X-rays 30,000 miles out to the sunward side of the comet nucleus. So at any rate, this is a bit of an analysis here of the Rosetta data that was released last week. And once again, to summarize what they said, let me just read the abstract on the air here. See if we can quick pull this up. It says, this is the abstract. It says, Cometary Science Report, Science Magazine. And Katrine Altweg is the lead scientist on this. It says the abstract, the provenance of water and organic compounds on the Earth and other terrestrial planets has been discussed for a long time without reaching a consensus. And what she's referring to is that the organic compounds and water of Earth have been discussed as being sourced by comets. Here they are staring at a comet, they go on to talk about the results. So once again, I'm going to start and read this over again just so it's in one piece. I'm going to read this in its entirety. The provenance of water and organic compounds on the Earth and other terrestrial planets has been discussed for a long time without reaching a consensus. One of the best means to distinguish between different scenarios is by determining the DH ratios in the reservoirs for comets and the Earth's oceans. Here we report the direct in situ measurement of the DH ratio in the Jupiter family comet 67P Shoei Umov, Gary Smenko, by the Rosina mass spectrometer aboard the ESA's Rosetta spacecraft, which is found to be 5.3 plus or minus 0.7 times 10 to the minus 4. That is about 3 times the terrestrial value. Previous cometary measurements and our new findings suggest a wide range of DH ratios in the water within Jupiter family objects and preclude the idea that this reservoir is solely composed of Earth ocean-like water. And so what they're basically saying is, hey, this ain't happening. The idea that comets formed the water on Earth or were the cause of it or the source of it ain't happening. 3 times the difference is huge. And so, at any rate, then they go on to say, off the record, that this could be due to, like I said before, asteroids maybe in the early solar system had more water, and that was the source of water, but it's pure speculation. They don't have any evidence for that. It's just beyond pure speculation. So, at any rate, I'm going to jump off this topic. But many, many listeners wrote in asking me to comment on this. And so in summary, they measured with the Rosetta spacecraft spectrometer, they measured the atmosphere above the comet nucleus. They did not measure this coming off the nucleus. Excuse me. And I explained the process by which water... This is one of the big mistakes that comet scientists have made from the very beginning, whether it was the Giacobini-Zinner flyby back in the mid-80s, up to the Halley's Comet flybys, up to the other comet build, the Deep Impact, whatever it was. The mistake that comet scientists continue to make is that when they see what they call the neutrals, the neutral water ions, or any other species, in fact, but primarily it's water, when they see those coming back off of the comet, the region around the comet nucleus, they think that that's coming from the nucleus, and it's not. It is not coming from the nucleus because the nucleus doesn't have any material to provide that. There's no water, there's no heavy water, there's no organic molecules. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. There might be some blasts of dust, but what they're seeing is as the water forms, it comes in, it continues to be attracted until it gets right into that zone around the comet nucleus that is negatively charged, and they are neutralized and they come floating out in the solar wind, but they're not forming from the comet nucleus. Another mistake, and so here they're reporting falsely, they're observing this coming off the nucleus, and what they should be reporting, if such a thing is happening, is that the lander landed there and it should have its coming up its nostrils right at the surface of the comet. It's right there on top of the nucleus, and they're not seeing it, and they're not releasing the data, and this is falsification of data at its very best. What more can you say about that? Okay, I'm going to change topics here. I've got a couple minutes left. I want to discuss the prime number. Now, this is something I've talked about before. 2007, March 5th of 2007, I released the book Calculate Primes. And at that time, there had been a lot of work with that material before it ever got to the public domain in the book Calculate Primes. And one of the things that had happened was that that material had been submitted for publication in a mathematical journal. It had already passed the hands of quite a few engineers, etc., and mathematicians who were familiar somewhat with that topic, but also people who are not familiar, just to get a handle on people's ability to understand what I was saying. So at any rate, the article was published or submitted for publication, and it ends up in the hands of a guy named Terry Tao and Ben Green, two guys who are the main referees for prime number work. for the American Mathematical Journal, American Institute of Mathematics Journal. And so anyway, they reject the article from publication for two reasons. One is that it didn't have enough references, and I explained that the it did not have references because it was completely new work. Secondly, it was not in the form of a mathematical proof. Those were the criticisms. There was no criticism that somehow there was a flaw in thinking or logic. But here's the problem. Here is the problem. And now, just want to remind you that my book that came out more recently, 5 years later, or I think it was 7 years later. Yeah, it was 2012. 2014, March 15th. Yeah, that's right. Last March, March 5th. So exactly 7 years later to the day, the book Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit was the public release of that information, showing that the RSA codes that are used for encryption and firewalls had been broken by that book, Calculate Primes. But the fact that secure computing, you have to read that book. It's a complicated topic. But the point I want to make tonight is more on a pure mathematical level. The work that has been around for 150 years, which is the solution to the Riemann hypothesis, which has to do with the density of prime numbers and various interpretations of that. This is a very complex mathematical analysis topic. One of the results of the Tao Green work, which they published, won the Field Prize for, as my work was coming out, they were receiving the Field Prize, stating that prime numbers were random. Anybody can read my book and understand that prime numbers are anything but random. There are sophisticated patterns, there's symmetry, there's all kinds of mathematical properties, there's symmetry, reciprocity, closure, wave-like nature, but there's an extremely important end result that has to do with the density of primes, and the blockage of this material and the continued promotion that prime numbers are random is really an adverse situation in the world of mathematics. And so that's it in a nutshell. It's a very complex topic, and I'm running out of time here. I wish I had a few more minutes to talk about that. Just remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, www.jmccsci.com. S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. The water filters, the personal water filters, the pre-filters, the books, the Recalendar Sunstar Clock, all of the various unique products that are there. And we're just about out of time. We're almost out of this year, in fact. I'll see you next week. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.